Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with me. I'm Bill Arnold. I'm glad that we are going to be together today. I hope you're having a great week, and we're kind of on the verge of that Independence Day weekend holiday tomorrow, and maybe you're going to squeeze in an extra day off on Friday. Wouldn't that make for a nice long weekend? It would be great. I hope you're, anyway, I hope your day's been good, and I hope if you're just climbing into the car, you can spend some time with me. Hopefully you're not stuck in traffic, but we're going to talk to Rob Bluey, who I normally talk to on Tuesdays, throwing off my whole week. I think I'll be able to catch up emotionally within a month or so. But Rob's going to be joining me. He's the executive editor of the Daily Signal. DailySignal.com is where I go for my news. That's where I check out all the articles that I want to read and get informed about. And the articles there are written with integrity and clarity. And you will love DailySignal.com. You're going to need to go check it out. And then Jack Alexander is going to be joining me in this first hour. Jack is a brilliant businessman who's recently not only written a book on mercy, but he is now in his next phase. I'm going to just leave that as a big tease because what he's got coming up next is quite interesting. We're going to be joining Jack in the second half of the hour. But let's get started with Rob. Let's take 60 seconds, and then he'll join us on our studio line.
Pray Together Sunday is a simple opportunity for your church to join with congregations across America and ask God for the same thing, that we would be people who love God and love others well. Talk to your church about participating during its July 7th worship service. Register at nae.net/praytogether. The National Association of Evangelicals is where we use influence for good.
Do you have a story to share? We'd love to hear how Faith Radio impacts your life. Leave us a message on our Faith Line at 877-933-2484.
I love Faith Radio and listen to it all the time, and I'm grateful for all that you do. And thank you for all that you do.
The Faith Radio Faith Line, a place to share your story. 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go stop and say hello.
Welcome to the show. Rob Bluey is just one of my very favorite guests every week. I so look forward to talking to him. He is the executive editor of the Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com to read all of the brilliant reporting that is done on that website. Rob, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Bill. Thanks for having me on a Wednesday.
I know. Tell me, I'm completely thrown off. All right.
Well, I hope I didn't throw you off too much. We just had our snafu yesterday, but look, the news never stops. So any day of the week, I'm happy to talk to you.
So let's start with the serious news. Did the Bluey boys, do they get to play with sparklers tomorrow?
I actually took my youngest to the fireworks stand in Virginia on Sunday, so okay. We got some age-appropriate things like sparklers under close parental supervision, of course.
Of course. That's a given. All right, let's talk about the news because it never ends. I'm interested in your response to how Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez seems to be getting a little bit bolder with her lies about the border crisis.
Yeah, it's really been interesting. Of course, she made those comments about the border detention facilities being concentration camps that enraged a number of people, including Holocaust survivors. Now she's taken a trip to actually see firsthand and has made some more accusations that are not sitting well with either the Border Patrol or some other members of Congress, including Congressman Dan Crenshaw, who represents a district in Texas. So, look, the one thing that we know about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is she is a media star, and whatever she says is going to attract attention. So I think that sometimes the most outlandish things come out of her mouth. And in that case, we don't know if they're always true. And I think this is a perfect example of where there are some people calling her out on it. And we'll ultimately see. I mean, these are highly choreographed visits that members of Congress make. There's usually video cameras and audio. So, you know, if she is telling the truth, I expect that there would probably be a way to prove whether or not some of the things that we're hearing about drinking water out of toilets and other terrible conditions that she describes would be able to be proven one way or the other.
Rob, does some of this feel like propaganda? I know there was that horrific response she had, seeing the horror of the detention as she was standing at the fence. And some other reporters said she was actually looking at an empty parking lot at the time.
Yeah, well, right. That's what I mean. I do think sometimes there is a tendency, and look, this is not this happens on both sides of the aisle. I mean,
there are certain
people who love the spotlight and will do or say anything to be in that spotlight. She has found an ability through social media and through the media following that she attracts to be able to do that. There are Republicans who do similar stunts. And look, I don't think it's productive, Bill, to we have a serious crisis that we're dealing with. Look, it took months for many people in the media to finally admit that it was a crisis. You had people like Jim Acosta and Joe Scarborough who openly said that this is not a crisis. And then you started to see that change last week when an overwhelming bipartisan number of members of Congress, both in the Senate and the House, decided to finally support $4.6 billion in aid because I think they recognize that the conditions there are not ideal. The Border Patrol is overwhelmed with the number of people who are crossing illegally. And so rather than performing some of these stunts that we've seen from presidential candidates and other members of Congress, let's just focus on the humanitarian needs of the people and hopefully try to find ourselves in a better situation where, you know, whether it's reforming the asylum laws or getting them the help that they need back in their home countries, we hopefully can move beyond the situation that we're currently finding ourselves.
And there you go, making sense again, Rob.
Well, you know, Bill, it's I think it's one of those things where if you actually get people to sit down and find some common ground, they would agree.
Oh.
You and I have talked about as Christians how we have deep compassion for these illegal immigrants. We certainly respect the rule of law, and we wish that they would as well. There are people who are waiting for years to do this process the legal way and to become American citizens through a naturalization ceremony. And then there are those who want to cut to the front of the line. And obviously, we need to put the rule of law first, but at the same time, we can't forget that these are people who ultimately want to come to America because it's such a great country. And wow, what a week to see a contrast in that. You have one of the iconic American brands who doesn't seem to show that same patriotism and love of country for the very people who are risking their life to make that dangerous journey.
And Rob, it seems in short time, there was no crisis at all. Then there was a manufactured crisis. Now there's a full-blown crisis. That all happened pretty quickly.
That's what I mean. And look, there have been some pictures surfacing from 2014 or earlier where you've had detention facilities that have looked very much the same way. Yet when President Obama was in office, you didn't necessarily hear about this. I think it's one of the reasons that President Trump is in the White House today. I think he took this issue and he knew that the American people were concerned about the illegal immigration. They saw the effects on their community. They particularly saw it with the drugs and the opioids coming across the border and it ravaging people in ways that were really hitting home to so many families throughout the Midwest and places that President Trump outperformed where Republicans have traditionally struggled. So the consequences are far-reaching. It's not just border communities that are feeling the effects of this, and I think that you're absolutely right, Bill. It's one of those issues where we need to have less screaming and probably more solutions.
Yeah, Rob, I would love your response to this. This was a tweet that Ari Fleischer put out, which I found fascinating. He said, if crossing the border illegally is no longer illegal, as several Democrats advocate, why do we make people who get off airplanes go through customs?
Yeah, well, right. That would certainly cut down on some of the lines there. I had a friend who recently picked up his parents and said it took 3 hours to get through customs here at Dulles Washington Airport, which is a big hub for international travelers. So, yeah, I know Ari Fleischer makes a point. Look, we saw this on display at the Democratic presidential debate last week when asked if they would provide health care to illegal immigrants. Every single person on that stage raised their hand. That's only going to create an incentive for more people to cross the border illegally and put their lives at risk. It's going to create a deeper crisis. So I frankly don't understand how we've gone so extreme, to the point where President Obama led, in many cases, President Trump in terms of deportations. And yet now the Democratic Party has completely flipped. It seems that there's a desire to deport no one and provide free health care. As President Trump himself said, shouldn't we focus on Americans who are struggling to get health care before those who are crossing the border and violating the rule of law?
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, I'm with you on all these points. Now, we're going to celebrate Independence Day tomorrow, and I think for almost 40 years there's been celebrations going on the National Mall. And now all of a sudden there's this huge interest in the cost of the celebration tomorrow. I wonder why.
Yes. Well, it's because of Donald J. Trump.
Oh,
that's why.
Yeah, that's it.
He has a certain tendency to create controversy. You know, I just spoke to Brent Bozell and Tim Graham, who are the co-authors of a book called Unmasked. And I asked them this question. I said, well, why is it that whatever Trump touches seems to create such controversy? And certainly this July 4th celebration is the most recent example of that. Now, let's face it, President Trump wants to do some things that are unorthodox for Washington, D.C.'s 4th. We're going to have some flyovers of military jets. We're going to have a couple of tanks on display. He's going to give a speech at the Lincoln Memorial. These are things that traditionally haven't happened in the past, but frankly, he's celebrating America. This is not a campaign event. It is a celebration of our country. I would think that people would be proud about it. Frankly, Bill, I am so disappointed in our hometown newspaper, The Washington Post, which has branded this as Trump's fourth, as if there's a distinction between what President Trump is doing and what Americans celebrate. I mean, why is it so controversial to celebrate the independence of America? I mean, this is truly disheartening, and I really hope that it's a great day tomorrow. I will be in the city. I will not be attending the salute because the Heritage Foundation has a great celebration of its own, and so we'll be watching the fireworks from a little bit further away on Capitol Hill.
When you look at the way people can criticize how money's being spent, I was on heritage.org looking at some of the government waste. I did find that kind of interesting. There's 10,160 earmarks, and they include things like $200,000 for a tattoo removal program in Mission Hills, California, on and on. The federal government owns more than 50,000 vacant homes, and more than $13 billion in Iraq aid has been classified as wasted, and another $7.8 billion cannot be accounted for. We have some problems with money, don't we?
We certainly do. And this is why we have a $22 trillion national debt and why the deficits continue to increase. This is one of the areas where I think President Trump could exert some real leadership. But he has not shown a willingness to cut spending. He regularly signs these bills when they arrive on his desk, and he always laments the fact, usually after he signs them, that he's never going to do this again and this needs to stop. Well, it's time to put the foot down now and to oversee some reforms. It's one of the reasons that the Heritage Foundation has created a budget called the Blueprint for Balance, which at a time when almost no politician in Washington says that the budget can be balanced, we've shown that it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
It can be done in about a decade, and we've identified over 250 spending cuts. So you cited some of them there, but there are plenty of other areas where Congress can look to trim its fat. The problem is, in some cases, they're parochial interests. So nobody wants to cut a program that's going to have some impact on their community back
sure.
home. And even though Congress said that they got rid of earmarks long ago, we still find ways that they try to sneak them in. And that's one of the areas that needs to be an area of reform. And frankly, Bill, nobody wants to touch the big programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, but that's what's really driving a lot of the spending and future growth. So there needs to be a serious conversation across the board about what we're spending our money on.
I agree. Rob Louie is my guest, executive editor of the Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com. We'll take a short break and join back with Rob in just a minute. Talking to Rob Bluey, and he was just mentioning the national debt, $22 trillion. I think the way he said that, it made it sound like it was a lot.
It sure is, Bill. Let me tell you, it's
just
so much money that nobody can even fathom what it is. And the best way to do it, I heard my colleague Romina Boccia, who is an expert on federal spending and budget and somebody who does a really good job of breaking it down. You really do have to put this in the context of you know, your own personal situation and try to explain what it would be like if you were to have that much money on your credit card and break it down into a size that seems proportional to your own situation. And trust me, it is frightening to think about what we're leaving the next generation. And as a father with kids, you know, they're going to be faced with some hard choices. I mean, it might be we might be able to escape this in our lifetime, but future generations are going to have to grapple with those tough questions.
Yeah. All right, Rob, you got to help me sort this one out. When Supreme Court nominee Ruth Bader Ginsburg appeared before the Senate, she said that her rule was no hints, no forecasts, no previews. All right. That's probably the way it should be done. Now, Bernie Sanders said that he would never, if he became president, would never appoint anyone or nominate any justice unless that justice is 100% clear he or she will defend Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, we've come a long way since Ruth Bader Ginsburg issued those remarks. And, you know, look, conservatives who have been nominated have used the Ginsburg standard in their own testimony before the Senate when asked questions like that. I mean, you might get it as a Supreme Court nominee or even just a regular district court nominee. So, it's one of those things where, I think that there is, again, a double standard here. And look, if your listeners disagree with me, this is where we always like to hear the feedback. When President Trump was running for office, he made a bold decision to release a list of potential nominees that he would pick from for the Supreme Court. And that's exactly what he did. Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh were on that list. I'm proud to say that my colleague John Malcolm helped develop that list, and we published it on the Daily Signal long before President Trump was ever elected. It was all a very transparent process, and people had plenty of time to learn about the nominees. On the left, and some of those nominees that Bernie Sanders is talking about are now being developed as part of a secret list by a number of organizations who do not plan to share it publicly. And I think that that's unfortunate because I think, again, if that same type of thing was being done among conservatives, there would be all sorts of media outlets crying from the rooftops that they needed to see that list. So we'll see. We'll see what ultimately these presidential candidates end up doing. I do know that that President Trump's decision to do that, though, I think gave those voters confidence that he would pick somebody who was qualified for the court and wouldn't necessarily make decisions. Bill, one other story that you and I talk about the Supreme Court a lot. You know, I thought it was very interesting that in the analysis of Brett Kavanaugh's first term, did you know he was just about as much likely to vote with Neil Gorsuch as he was Elena Kagan? So despite what people might perceive about these nominees, sometimes it works out differently when the cases come before them. And it's not necessarily always the big cases where they're siding. Some of the cases that don't get as much attention might be up there as well in terms of the conservative-liberal collaboration. But, you know, it's not necessarily always what we think.
Yeah. All right. One pair of tennis shoes seems to be making a lot of news, causing a lot of trouble. Let's talk about this Nike kerfuffle.
It sure is. Yes. Well, this is something that, I've heard people say this is a conspiracy on Nike's part just to get us to talk about it.
Because it's working.
It's Nike in the news. But yes, Colin Kaepernick apparently didn't like the Betsy Ross flag, the original flag on the back of the Nike sneakers. So they've decided to nix the sneakers, not issue them. I think it's unfortunate. And we've seen some ramifications already. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey has decided to pull some taxpayer back exact incentives that Nike was going to get for doing business in Arizona. You know, and it's one of those things where I think, you know, you can have it both ways. There are those who might be on Colin Kaepernick's side and really applauding Nike's decision, but there's, I think, probably more Americans out there who are fed up with this type of political correctness and saying, look, especially on the week of Independence Day, how can you pull a stunt like this?
Yeah. What did you think of President Trump visiting Kim Jong-un in the DMZ, stepping foot into North Korea as the first sitting president to ever do that? What were your thoughts about that?
Well, it's certainly a historic moment, Bill, but I think it comes at a time when we really haven't seen as much progress in North Korea as we'd like. And those listeners out there who may be big Trump fans probably won't want to hear me say this, but you know, we really do need to see holding North Korea accountable as one of the first priorities. They continue to test those short-range missiles, which is not good. These photo ops, which is really what this was, you know, they're hopefully a good step in the right direction diplomatically. Certainly, I'd rather have us talking than fighting. But it's time that we really hold North Korea accountable for some of its actions. After all, let's not forget that this is a dictator who murders his own people, who tortures them in gulags. It is a terrible system for the people in North Korea. And really, we need to be looking out for them and not the interests of Kim Jong-un.
Rob, why is South Korea so interested in unifying with North Korea?
Well, look, I mean, they don't want the military threat. I mean, it's as North Korea's closest neighbor, obviously they're right there, and they would suffer grave consequences if North Korea ever decided to do something drastic. So I think it's in their interest, as well as Japan, to try to see some resolution to this. Look, I think that President Trump has a great heart, and he sees the potential for North Korea to be a country that perhaps someday adopts Western values. I'm somewhat skeptical of whether that's going to happen in my lifetime. I think we've seen the situation with China and Hong Kong. Remember, when China was developed this 50-year treaty with Hong Kong, the idea there was that China over time would develop more Western values. Instead, we've seen China move in the opposite direction with corruption and the communist leadership there, certainly trying to upend the rule of law and take away the rights of Hong Kong people. And I think that any time you have a situation where socialism or communism is the dominant philosophy, that tends to be the direction you go. And frankly, that's what we're contending with in the case of North Korea. So if we can move them in a different direction, I think South Korea and other neighbors there would heartily agree with us. But it's going to take some heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm. I saw a tweet that Bernie Sanders put out, which I found interesting. He said 10% of American households struggle with food insecurity and have to skip meals for financial reasons. I would assume people have been skipping meals for financial reasons for a long, long time.
I would say so. They're probably skipping meals for dietary reasons as well. I mean, let's face it. There's some days that I'm just too busy to eat lunch, Bill. But no, I mean, look, it's another one of those issues where I don't think the government is the answer here. I mean, I honestly think that this is what where it comes down to having some personal responsibility, strong family values, and frankly, a good job. I mean, this is why jobs are so important and why I think ultimately, at the end of the day, the success we've seen over the past few years with President Trump and the focus on jobs has been so helpful to millions of Americans because it's helped them provide for their families in a way that probably the government is not long-term going to be able to do.
Yeah. And if there's a food insecurity, you know, that tells me that someone is eating more than their fair share.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
And we can fix that. Rob, have a nice Independence Day. Blessings to you and your family. Thanks again for joining me on this Wednesday. I'll see you next Tuesday.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks. Rob Bluey's been my guest, executive editor of the Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com. Bookmark that. It's a good place to go for your news and your information. Great website, great writers, lots of integrity. Be right back.
10:30 a.m. on Faith Radio.
Welcome back to the show. Thanks to Rob Bluey for coming on. Every time Jack Alexander writes or speaks, I pay attention. I especially like it when he says yes to coming on to the show. He is the founder of Reimagine Group, and he's got a business background and an entrepreneur. He's co-founded and built several businesses and technology companies. He's authored a couple of books, The God Guarantee and The God Impulse, and he's written a great book on the power of mercy in an unmerciful world called The God Impulse. It's a great book, and now he's got something else on his heart that I can't wait to find out about. Jack, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bill. How are you today?
I'm well. I always like talking to you. I always walk away with something significant.
Well, it's a joy to be with you.
Yeah, thank you. So I was reading about your work with Barna, and I'm thinking, this got under your skin, didn't it?
It really did. You know, in my book, I talked about this concept of the outsourcing of compassion, mm-hmm. how people are so busy, they don't have time to build relationships. And so I sort of took my advance and hired Barna to get the data. And sure enough, they found out that 83% of Christians feel like it's not their personal responsibility to show mercy. It's a responsibility of 1.6 million nonprofits and the government and the church. So it's just been exciting to walk with David Kinnaman and the Barna group in digging into this data that can be used as really a leverage to help bring healing to the church.
It's such an important message, and I think it's never been more timely than now. I mean, there seems to be more polarization, more division, more people distancing themselves and not showing the mercy that you talk about in your book.
Well, in the book, we talked about this, you know, Psalm 25:10 says, all the ways of the Lord are mercy and truth. And it's almost like conservatives have an appropriate high view of mercy, or truth and a lower view of mercy, and liberals have a higher view of mercy and a lower view of truth. And then people fight about it. And so that's where we're trying to break this stalemate and sort of bring people to the middle.
So let's talk about the project of racial reconciliation. This is something on your heart, and you dove into this with both feet.
Yeah. Well, when I was writing the book, I saw the implications of it, and I prayed to the Lord, you know, just what practically can I do? And sort of what I felt like the Spirit said was really lean into this area of racial unity and healing. And over the last 10 years, God had brought a number of great friends who are African-American into my life. You know, one where we'd meet, you know, regularly for accountability. Plus, I had mentored a young African-American man for about the last 36 years who's been in prison and had all sorts of difficult circumstances. So I felt like he always teaches us before we're allowed to speak, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like he was just teaching me a lot in this area. And, you know, my book talks about that mercy begins with knowing someone's story. And I started asking friends, you know, what do you know about the Homestead Act or the GI Bill or the Dred Scott decision or Jim Crow laws or something like that. And I just found an incredible lack of knowledge in the white church of what the African-American race has gone through for 400 years. And I was grateful to be part of a group at Stone Mountain where we had 25,000 people come together and pray against the stronghold of racism in our nation.
Wow, that's amazing. And I'm looking at some stats, and one is that half of practicing Christians, 50%, believe the United States' history of slavery continues to impact Black Americans today.
Yeah, well, I think I'd probably even say it the other way, that half of U.S. Christians don't believe that slavery has any implications today. And I was recently talking to a doctor at Emory University, and he studies PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and he's talking about the effect that has on our brain and even our genetics they're studying now. And so when you look at probably 20 generations of African-Americans who saw relatives sold off, women raped, you know, just all the injustices, you know, what, you know, if African-Americans are my neighbor and I'm to love them as I love myself, what kind of investment can we make in really understanding the story and the past? And so that's really what I've been doing the last couple of years.
Jack, it seems like we struggle looking through somebody else's lens, don't we?
Yeah, we really do. I interviewed a guy named Eric Mason, who's a top African-American pastor in Philadelphia, and he wrote a book called The Woke Church. And in it, he says the two worst moments of an African-American's life are when they realize they're Black and when they realize that's a problem. And I've watched videos of African-American children, like 3-4 years old, with a white doll and a dark doll, and them repeatedly choosing the white doll. And so I think there's something deep here, and I think that it deserves the compassion of the church.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious as to what you think the generational gap in views of, you know, race and racism, why it still persists today.
Well, I think there's great data about millennials that millennials, I think, are 50% more likely to realize that there are continuing implications, generational implications from whether it's slavery or Jim Crow laws or just even like my dad was a beneficiary of the GI Bill and the African-Americans who fought with him couldn't get a GI loan. And so when you think about how net worths are built, you know, a lot of times it happens with the ability to buy a house. So I think that the younger generation is just way ahead of the boomers and the elders in the Barna data. Only 8% of older white conservative Christian men believe we should lament and repent over this whole issue.
What's that percentage, Jack?
8%.
That's stunning.
And really, when I ask God, like, why am I? I'm a businessman. I'm a conservative. You know, why am I even doing this? And it's almost like I represent the perpetrator. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution just finished two interviews with me, and you know, I'm one of four people being featured in this series of articles they're writing about people trying to make a difference. And the only thing I can think of is that I sort of represent the person that needs to change in our society. And so that's why I feel like this burden, I feel this burden to really research and read and understand. And I tell you, the African-American friends I have, when they see me doing that, I can't even tell you the type of connection that I feel, that it's almost like, you know, you're willing to invest in my story. And I think when we're doing that, that's a very practical way of showing love.
Mm-hmm. So as I would love to just talk about the racial reconciliation, and when we say those words, what do we mean?
I think you used some great words a few minutes ago about looking at something through someone else's eyes.
Okay.
You know, if your 3-year-old or 4-year-old doesn't want a doll of the same race they are, and what type of messaging is in our society, and how I talked to a group of wealthy men and I asked them to all think about their net worth and just what would their net worth be if they were African American. And for me, I said I was hired by a billionaire from Europe when I was 32 years old, and we went on to build two companies together. And if I was Black, I don't think he would have hired me, you know? So literally that was 20 years of my business career that would not have happened the way it happened if I was African-American. I think liberals have taken words like privilege and fragility, and I think they're trying to politicize them, which sort of, I think, can rob us of really healthy dialogue when things get politicized. But I think it's really something to understand that whether it's, you know, 15% of our population is African-American and 50% of our prisoners are African-American. I think to really get beyond the data and understand the stories, like the book Just Mercy that was written, you know, won an award, you know, and it just tells the stories of these prisoners, and it changes your view.
Yeah. I know that in Revelation, it talks about that every nation and tribe and people and language will be in heaven. And I'm wondering if we are being intentional enough about having diversity in our personal circles.
Well, the Barna data, it basically says a lot of us know African Americans, but we don't have close relationships. Only 10% of conservative evangelical Christians have a close relationship with someone who looks or believes differently than they do. And yesterday I drove from Alpharetta downtown, which is like 20 minutes. I did it over lunch just to meet this guy who works in a soup kitchen, and I've had a 36-year relationship with him, and he wants to be a carpenter, and I was able to get him some money to buy some tools, and you know, we spent 45 minutes hanging out. And you know, in my book, I talk about mercy. The Hebrew word is rakem, which means it's like the whole idea of a womb. And that mercy, when a baby is in a mother's womb, the mother shapes the baby, but the baby also shapes the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that picture, because when we get involved with people differently than us, we get reshaped. And I think that's part, I mean, sanctification is something that God does, but I really believe as we lean into relationships with people different than us, it reshapes us.
Mm-hmm. Jack, what is the, maybe you'd explain to the listening audience what what you understand the Black Lives Matter movement is.
Yeah, well, I remember watching the Democratic debates, and they would say, do you believe all lives matter or Black Lives Matter? And people would say Black Lives Matter, and I would just be outraged.
Yeah.
I would say, like, how in the world can somebody answer that question,
uh-huh,
Black Lives Matter? But right now, if I was asked that question, I would say Black Lives Matter, because behind it, it's they're really asking, when we get shot, when we get imprisoned, are you seeing it? I think it's just like a cry for help, and it's a cry for understanding. And I think sometimes when it's just like, if we had a conversation and you're not hearing me, my voice might get louder. And I feel like Black Lives Matter is sort of, it's, and I don't agree with everything Black Lives Matter does, but I think it's a cry to get whites to, I think, do what we're trying to do with these resources of digging in and understanding. And again, I've walked into this probably like any of your radio listeners. I think if you took me 5 or 10 years ago, I think, and we were asked 50 questions, we'd probably all answer them the same way. And I've been reshaped by studying the history, by understanding it, by having African-American friends. I simply look at this whole area through a different lens right now, and I've been enriched by it. And I think I've been able to be a better friend to people as well.
Mm-hmm. Jack, what can Christians agree upon as we try to pursue racial justice, you know, regardless of where we're coming from?
Well, I think that's what I truly try to tackle in my book, The God Impulse, is that Jesus, when he said, go and do likewise, I believe it was a statement he was making for our horizontal relationships with each other. And the first step was mercy, and that's the reason I call it the God Impulse, is that I believe that God's impulse towards us, his first thing when he thinks about Bill Arnold, is mercy.
Thank
and
you.
To me, that's an incredible concept.
Oh, is it ever? Just hearing you say that about me is just making me tear up.
I mean, Bill, I interview people, and for the last years, and I say, how many times have you totally messed up in your life, and the equivalent of an authority figure like the Father runs to you and embraces you?
Oh, boy.
And people will say, like, well, that happened this one time, or people look at me, and they'll literally have tears in my eyes, and they say, that's never happened, or they'll recount. I've had two stories, one from a man and one from a woman, who talked about a pregnancy before marriage, calling the parents and just getting absolutely reamed out. And so I think that where I'm going with this is the third step of the God impulse, the see, go, do, endure, is doing. So that's actually the step of justice. And so I honestly believe that God set up biblical love in a way that if mercy is an engaged heart, that we literally can't have a just society or just relationships until we get our hearts engaged. it would be the equivalent of me saying, if you had some needs and I said, Bill, I'll do all those things for you. I'll treat you justly, but I don't care about you and your family. You'd say, forget about it.
Mm.
I think there's something about this impulse that we have of our heart is engaged, our heart's inclined. We have a disposition to hear people's stories and to listen instead of to judge.
Jack, I could listen to you all day, but I do need to take a short break. We'll be back with Jack Alexander in just a minute. I am glad to be speaking to Jack Alexander. He's written a book called The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World, and seeing that everywhere Jesus went, he preached and healed, and he offered truth and hope and mercy and brought healing. And we are in a racially divided country where we struggle for loving each other and racial reconciliation. And Jack, you are a great voice in this discussion. And I'm curious, are we as churches doing enough, or do we need to do more, or do we need to do things smarter?
Well, I think that's a complicated question. Barna found, and again, I'm a conservative Christian. I go to a PCA church. They found that liberal churches have a tendency to look at things in more of a systemic way. Structures that really create inequities, that create chronic need. And conservatives have a tendency to look at things more individually. So I can say I'm from Connecticut. I don't think my family owns slaves. And I'm not a racist. You know, where we can, because we look at things individually, it's easier to dismiss the issue. And I think to me, there's a beauty in looking at it individually as well as a system. That's all I had to say.
Yeah, I love the story of you driving across town the other day to meet with a gentleman who you're helping become a carpenter. You know, these stories, and I love if you've got another story like it, because I know listeners just really attach to those, and they go, I could do that.
Yeah, my wife met an African-American. She works at an inner-city clinic. She met an African-American woman who was unemployed, and she noticed that her teeth, you know, weren't in good shape and her breath smelled. And she took, I think, 8 different trips to take her to a dentist to get dentures. And 2 of the times the woman didn't show up. So it wasn't like an easy thing to do. And, you know, I think it cost us, it was at a clinic, so we got a good rate, but I think it cost us $2,000 or something like that. And on my phone, I've got a beautiful picture of this woman with a big smile, and she was able to get a job. And, you know, so I think it's the neighbor thing, but that's why we can't outsource this, because we can't give a check to somebody who will then in the nonprofit do that. And so I think that, you know, when people ask me what's the biggest thing I learned in the study of mercy is that I used to think it was a cost, and now I think it's an investment that returns.
Mm.
You know, Jesus says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. And I literally believe that when we lean into this type of life, God visits mercy on us and those we love in ways that we can't even imagine.
Mm-hmm. So, Jack, I'd love for you to say more about, you know, serving people and doing it firsthand, doing it in person. I mean, a lot of people would think, well, I'm willing to give money or some of my resources. But what I just heard you say, this firsthand experience really makes a significant difference.
Well, I think the biggest firsthand experience, and again, what the Barna data showed, was that people see mercy as, I want to help the widow, I want to help the orphan, I want to help the hurricane victim. And by a factor of 5 to 1, they don't want to help their enemy. By a factor of 10 to 1, they don't want to help a prisoner. So that was, Bill, probably the biggest thing I found in terms of how the church misunderstands mercy, is the Samaritan story was a story of the Samaritan went to his hated enemy, the Jews, who burned down their place of worship. and he basically did everything for him. He spent the night with him, taking care of him. And so I think that the Barna study found out that 25% of Christians have somebody in their life they can't forgive. And if you're a millennial, it's 33%. And they also said that they believe those statistics are underreported. So if you want to be merciful, think right now about somebody who has offended you. And I know that I was an enemy of Jesus's, and my business, a business transferred me to Australia. And I feel like Jesus like chased me down, and he loved me when I was his enemy. And I think that we can each do that. So I think it doesn't have to be getting somebody new teeth or getting them, you know, some tools. I think it really, we're a religion of forgiveness. So when you see these large numbers of people who can't have people they can't forgive, I think that's probably the biggest practical thing. Because in the Lord's Prayer, it says that we will be forgiven as we forgive.
It's inspiring. We still live in a time of racism. That's probably never going to go away, is it, in this life?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that people, you know, we like people like ourselves. And I think part of the issue I've had with the church growth movement over the last, you know, 40 years was that they found that homogeneous churches grew faster. And so it became sort of a tenet of fast-growing churches to be homogeneous. And when you look in the books of Acts and how they treated women and how they treated the poor and how they treated children, it was a very holistic, multicultural church in the book of Acts.
Mm-hmm. I love great stories, and I'll tell you one, Jack, which I would love to brag about one of my mentors, but he worked, his name is Kerry, he worked in business for 44 years, and then retired, and 6 months later did a year-long mission trip into Ukraine in a 600-square-foot apartment without a shower. And then he came back after a year on the missions field and joined an all-black church here in Minnesota. And now he teaches Sunday school there. On any given Saturday night, there might be, you know, two or four African-American couples at his house for dinner.
That's very inspiring. Thank you for sharing that.
It inspires me because you can talk about it or you can just kind of go do it. And every time I think of talking about something, I always think of him and I think, well, he just went and did it, he and his wife. So it's a powerful story, and I love your book and your research, and you're such an inspiration when you come on. I always appreciate having you on, and I know my listeners love it too.
Well, thank you, Bill, and just thank you for giving this important topic a focus.
Yeah. All right. Jack Alexander has been my guest, and we're going to take a short break and be back in just a sec. Special thanks to Jack Alexander. His book is amazing. If you want to go look it up, it's called The God Impulse, The Power of Mercy in an Unmerciful World. That is a great book and a very moving book as well. And you can always go and download a free sample of it. If you just want to learn about the book and maybe get the first chapter for free, you can always do that. I always recommend that as a great way to get introduced to a book before you go ahead and make the big purchase. You can go and read a chapter and see if you like it or not. But everywhere Jesus went, he preached and healed, and he offered truth and mercy and hope. And that's what we need to do as believers. Coming up in hour two, we're going to be joined by Pastor Sam Storms. And then first time on the show, Rebecca McLaughlin is going to be joining us. And she's written a fascinating book that I picked up and that I couldn't put down. You're going to love hearing from her as well. That's all ahead on hour two of Afternoons with Me. I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for supporting Faith Radio. I have to tell you, you are the best ever. The way you so generously give, and it makes a big, big difference. We'll take a little break and be back with Hour 2 in just a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.